for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new intelligence estimate says the risk of cyber espionage is growing and now threatens U.S. competitiveness. Damage from cyber attacks costs U.S. companies billions of dollars in lost intellectual property each year, and attacks on critical infrastructure like oil and gas raise national security concerns. Joining me in the studio to talk about the growing problem of cyber espionage, Michelle Kwan of Michelle Kwan Associates, Michael Leiter of Palantir Technologies, and Ellen Nakashima of The Washington Post. Please feel free to join us, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
And Ellen Nakashima, if I could start with you. Tell us what's new in this intelligence assessment on cyber attacks.
Yes, Diane. Well, first, this is the first time the intelligence community has done an intelligence estimate focused exclusively on cyber economic espionage, on targets of commercial and business interest. And while the conclusion that China is the most aggressive actor in this area, it may not be surprising to many of us, the report makes clear that China is far and away the most aggressive, by maybe orders of magnitude greater than the next closest competitor, Russia, and then far down below that, say, France and Israel. And the report also makes clear that it is a wide variety of sectors that are targeted,
from Rodriguez.
The finance to oil and gas, renewable energy, clearly information technology, all areas that China is seeking to increase its own strength and competitiveness in the world economy.
And, of course, President Obama is expected to make an announcement tomorrow on new protective efforts against cyber hacking. What kinds of things is he going to announce?
Yes, he's going to announce an executive order on cybersecurity that will call for the creation of new voluntary standards or best practices that critical industries, critical sectors, maybe such as aviation and transportation, can and should take to make their systems more secure against cyber penetrations. These standards will be created with the executive branch agencies that regulate them in a sort of a voluntary process led by a Commerce Department agency. And the hope is eventually that they will be promulgated through rules in these executive agencies.
Ellen Nakashima of The Washington Post. She's national security reporter there. Michael Leiter, how do you react to Ellen's writings and her assessment of what's happening here?
I think Ellen's reporting is, first of all, right on the mark. It's quite clear to people who watch cybersecurity that economic espionage through cyber attacks and cyber penetrations has been an enormously increasing problem over the past 3 to 5 years. And if you go back to the Bush administration and the early Obama administration, they have prioritized this. And this national intelligence estimate, which is a statement by all 17 elements of the intelligence community, kind of the senior most level of intelligence analysis that the intelligence community produces, helps highlight. Now, of course, this is a classified document, but this sort of document highlights to the White House, highlights to the Congress, exactly what those threats are, the scale, where they're coming from, and helps push both the President and the Congress to action, as they've been talking about over the past several years.
You know, when you talk about the past several years, it seems to me that the whole notion of industrial espionage has been around for decades, but now heightened by cyber spying?
I think you're exactly right. This is not entirely new. We've always known espionage, and espionage used to focus on getting secrets from government. And then post-World War II, as the industrial complex grew, it moved into trying to penetrate defense contractors who made tanks and planes. And what we've seen over the past 5 to 10 years is an explosion of economic espionage. And what cyber allows to happen is vastly larger amounts of information to be stolen, with it being much more difficult for us to attribute who's responsible for that. And with that ability to steal vast amounts of information, the Chinese in particular have used this as a national economic policy to penetrate, as Ellen noted, not just defense industries, but oil and gas, energy, manufacturing, healthcare, agriculture, and all of the supporting elements around that, the law firms, the information service providers, and as we've also seen, journalists, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. So it has become a scale over the past several years which really dwarfs anything we've seen in history.
Michael Leiter, he's former director of the National Counterterrorism Center. Turning to you, Michelle Kwan, you don't see the issue as quite as large as you've heard.
I don't know if it's not quite as large. I think it's more it's not quite as new. I think this has been going on for quite a long time. We started taking moves on this in 1998. So this has been a long time process, I think, of identifying it and knowing what it is. Whether or not we can quantify if this has grown or not, I think is still out for judgment. And I don't know if it really matters. The long and the short of it is we have identified it as a large problem. And I see it as a large problem, not necessarily with the focus that started on government. I think there may not be a place that is more focused than the other. I don't think we know that yet. I think as we've moved our lives, as we've moved our businesses, our data, our processes, our money to the internet and to IT systems, so has crime and espionage and all of the other things that we used to deal with on a physical basis. You know.
So what are you saying? That we simply are dealing with a situation that's always existed, but now we have to find new tools to deal with it.
Well, it's always existed. The methods have changed from physical to IT. And we not only have to find ways of figuring out how to deal with it, but how to identify it. I think that has been the problem, and I think that's what we're getting better at, and that's what seems to be new. So not just we have to identify it, and that sometimes is difficult, but we also then need to put forth the effort to remediate the problems. I think we've moved our lives, our systems, our businesses, our money to the IT systems, and we use them as a priority, but we often don't take care of them the way we should, which leaves us vulnerable to these kinds of attacks. So it's more than defense. It's also taking care of the systems that we have so that they're not vulnerable.
This is certainly the first time I've ever heard the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal having been broken into. Isn't that new? And isn't that even more grave when a country, apparently China, is trying to get information or to hack into systems because they don't like what the New York Times has published?
I actually don't think it's new. I think it's new that they've identified it. I also think it's new that they're saying something about it. It's really hard to get entities to talk about the fact that they've been hacked. And so if we have the problem of difficult to identify, don't want to talk about it, that makes the remediation part of it even harder.
So what about the fact that the New York Times has indeed talked about this, Ellen?
Well, I think that on one hand, it was a very interesting and good piece of journalism to actually explore the way in which the hack occurred and to show how China was very much interested in exploring, in looking at the reporting of major news organizations who are doing investigative pieces on that are hard-hitting and often critical of the regime. It shows that this is not just theoretical, but it is happening. I think this has really begun to be an issue in the last several years. We reported that our own systems had been compromised several years ago. We did not discover it until, I think, 2011. But my understanding is China is interested in media organizations and what they're reporting to understand who their sources are, who they're talking to, what they might be about to report, what they're interested in, all sorts of intelligence that help them understand where, you know, points of criticism may be.
Let me understand what you just said. The Washington Post experienced hacking in 2010. It took until 2011 to discover it. Is that what you... I just want to be clear.
Yeah, we've reported that the Post discovered some of... discovered instances of being compromised, I think, in 2011. But it looked like the actual penetration had happened earlier.
Ellen Nakashima of The Washington Post. Short break. We'll be right back. And as we talk about growing concerns regarding cybersecurity, joining us now from his office in Alexandria, Virginia, Richard Baitlick of Mandiant, that's a cybersecurity firm. Richard, remind us of what happened to the New York Times back in the fall.
Thanks, Diane. The New York Times was publishing a story on Wen Jiabao's family finances, and they had interacted with the Chinese government and learned that there would be, in the Chinese words, consequences if they proceeded with publishing their piece. So on October 24th of last year, they asked their internet service provider if they had seen anything odd in terms of network traffic coming to and from the New York Times as a company. The ISP said yes, they had seen something odd, and that started an internal investigation at the Times. They spent about a week to 10 days trying to determine exactly what was going on, which computers were affected, and then they decided by November 7th they needed to call in some professional computer security assistance, and that's when they contacted Mandiant. We conducted an investigation. We found that the Times had been compromised since September 13th. And that the intruders had been targeting information relating to two of the reporters who had been working on the Wen Jiabao family story.
Tell me how you figured out what the Chinese were doing.
Well, the way a company like Mandiant works is we send consultants. We have special software that works on both computers and the network that contains all of the intelligence for the investigations we've done for the past 9 years. And we check out every computer in the company looking for signs that there are threat actors present. And in the course of that investigation, we found that there were intruders on the network. They had accessed 53 individual Times computers, and they were specifically looking for information related to the Wen family story. So using this, we were able to match that type of activity to a group that we internally refer to as APT-12, which is a group that operates out of China.
Now, we have an email here from Sarah. Could you please comment on the fact that the reason that many cyber attacks come out of China is because many cyber hackers run their IPs through China so that they cannot be traced? Can you answer that, Richard?
I'd be happy to. That's a valid concern. And the way to think about this is if you simply arrive on the scene of a cyber attack, and you've never done the work before, you only have the evidence at hand, it can be easy to be fooled by what the adversary is doing. And in fact, in the case with the Times, we saw them routing their activity out of universities in Arizona and other locations. In other words, we weren't seeing traffic going directly back to China. It's only by virtue of the infrastructure we have around the world and by virtue of helping our customers that we can see in places that get beyond what's happening just from that company out to their what we call their first hot points. So sure, if you were just looking at this and say, oh, I see traffic going to Florida, I see it going to Arizona, there is no overt tie to the Chinese. But when you take it that next level, when you take a look at what they're doing, how they're doing it, you match it up against the other intelligence work we've done, that's when we can figure out the attribution problem.
So how sophisticated was the attack on the New York Times?
Well, APT-12, when you rank them against the other groups that we track, they are fairly sophisticated. They're not as sophisticated as some of the other groups that we track, but they're not at the bottom end either. We found in the course of doing our intrusion response that just about any company can fall prey to this. It doesn't mean every company has, but if you face an intruder who decides they're coming for a certain piece of information or a certain individual, they can find a way. And that's where the P comes from in APT. That it stands for persistent.
And what about phishing? P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. And why it's such a favorite tactic of Chinese cyber spies?
Yeah, phishing is actually probably the most effective means to get into an organization that you've targeted. It's a means by which you send an email, either with an embedded link or perhaps a malicious attachment, that you're trying to entice the recipient to open up that message. And if you think about it, an organization like a media company, they're especially susceptible to this because they deal with sources, they're trying to get information from the outside world. So if someone sends them an email with some sort of a scoop or something that they'd be interested in, they're likely to open it up. And when they open up that email, malicious software will run on the user's computer, and it will allow an intruder, possibly thousands of miles away, to interact with that computer as if he was sitting right in front of it.
Now, explain the difference between what happens when a country or an organization tries to go phishing and the difference between that and spam that all of us tend to receive and sometimes are tricked into opening because it's from someone we know.
Yeah, spam and phishing are variations on the same theme. When someone sends spam, they're trying to get you to buy some type of product, and they hope that by volume, by sending out millions of messages, they'll get a few people to buy that product. Generally, in those messages, there's a link. It's a link to someone's online store where you can buy whatever product they're trying to sell. And so from that perspective, it's very similar to phishing. The difference with phishing is that when you click on that link or perhaps you open that attachment, the intruder is trying to take over your computer. They're not selling you anything. They're not trying to have you interact with them in a quasi-legitimate way. They're trying to get control of your computer so that they can then take documents from the computer, turn on the camera, listen to the microphone. More importantly, though, pivot from that computer to access other systems in your company to accomplish whatever their ultimate mission is.
You talked about your work with the New York Times. The Wall Street Journal was also attacked. And the question becomes, how long does it take a company like yours to figure out what's going on, where it's coming from, and how serious it is?
Well, a company like Mandiant, who's been doing this work for many years, when we have a substantial consulting force, in addition to the other tools that we bring to bear, the software we make available, our managed services, we can get to the root of the problem fairly quickly. In some cases, we're limited by the amount of information that may be left around, you know, the amount of forensic evidence that may be left inside an organization. But once we deploy our software and we have it backed by the intelligence of all the hundreds and hundreds of investigations we do of the same type that no one ever hears about, we can get to the root of the problem fairly quickly. The delay comes from what do you do about it? Most organizations have a tough time with their information technology. It's not easy to make these changes. Otherwise, that's why many companies would have tried to make those changes over the years. So really, the next challenge becomes, well, how do you deal with the problem now that you've found the intruder?
So you heard Michelle Kwan say earlier that this kind of cyber spying has been around for a while. Perhaps the problem has gotten bigger. But just how bad do you think this problem of cyber attacking is for U.S. businesses?
So I've been involved with this problem for the last 15 years, starting as a captain in the Air Force in San Antonio, Texas. And the difference back then was when I was wearing the uniform, I would see the Chinese and the Russians and other nations attacking Air Force computers and government computers. And that was just expected. That's what nations do to each other. The difference is that beginning in the early 2000s, the Chinese in particular expanded their activity way beyond what we would consider normal for the West. They started with the cleared defense contractors. They went to the national labs. They then expanded into private industry to the point we're at now where if you're doing business in China, if you're in advanced manufacturing, clean energy, autos, there's a whole suite of technologies that the Chinese are targeting. They have thousands of people devoted to this cyber espionage case. So, yes, espionage has been with us for all time. There's some great stories and books and movies about that. The difference is that you have state-sponsored and state-affiliated actors targeting private companies who, for the most part, aren't equipped or resourced to handle that sort of problem.
And that is the voice of Richard Baitlick of Mandiant. That's a cybersecurity firm. Richard, I hope you can stay on with us for the rest of the program.
I will. Thank you for the opportunity.
Good. Michelle Kwan, you've just heard what Richard had to say. How do you react to what happened at the Times, what happened at the Wall Street Journal, and his clear concerns that these kinds of attacks are growing?
Well, I do think that it's a problem. I just am more in the camp of thinking that we're just now identifying something that has been going on for a long time. I don't think it was a progression. I think it was more of a more comprehensive attack across sectors. It's just my personal opinion. I do think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's difficult to manage IT systems. It's difficult to get priority unless you can show that there have been attacks, and attacks are hard to identify, and it takes money. It takes money to identify.
And time.
It does take some time. But really, our focus should be on looking at how we remediate this problem. Our focus needs to be on how do we properly fund our systems and manage and control our systems so that those vulnerabilities are less and less. We will always have zero days, and we will always have more sophisticated attacks than the tools that we produce. It will always be a foot race to try and stay ahead of our adversaries. But with that in mind, we need to ensure that we take care of our systems, monitor our systems, and keep the hygiene of our systems to the best level so that there's less of a chance
and
of
the attacks. And
the
question becomes then, are we able to stay one step ahead of those who would like to infiltrate the system, Ellen Nakashima?
Yeah, I think one of the key issues here is to what degree is this a problem for the private sector alone, and to what degree is the government? Does the government play a role here, and how much of a partnership should the two have? What we're seeing is, as Mike pointed out, from the sort of toward the end of the Bush administration and certainly through this Obama administration, a growing recognition that this, especially the cyber economic espionage problem, is a problem that is significant, cannot be addressed by just one sector alone, really needs to be a collaboration, and importantly, something the entire government gets behind, not just the military or the intelligence agencies.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Michael Leiter, do you expect the government to get involved here?
Diane, the government already is involved, especially with the defense sector. There's been a program over the past several years to provide classified, sensitive types of signatures to defense contractors from the Defense Department, the National Security Agency, to give them a better ability to defend against these Chinese attacks. We also have to recognize that this isn't just about China. This isn't just about penetrating and stealing vast amounts of economic wealth. It also is moving into the more destructive realm. And it really doesn't take very much to go from being able to steal information to destroy information or disrupt people's networks.
Have we had situations where that's occurred?
We have. The two most significant over the past 18 months or so, first beginning in September of last year and going into December, several major U.S. financial institutions, an area of the economy which is actually better protected than most, experienced very extensive and increasingly sophisticated distributed denial of service attacks. So their websites were not accessible because they were being attacked by numerous computers from around the globe that were ultimately tracked back to Iran. Even more destructively, the largest oil company in the world, Saudi Aramco, and the second largest natural gas company in the world, Rosgas in Qatar, experienced very destructive attacks based in Iran, we believe, where in the case of Aramco, 30,000 computers were actually wiped clean by a cyber attack, again, emanating from Iran, which had been in Aramco computers for an extended period. So the point here is that if you can steal things, it really doesn't take much to also flip the switch and make that same code able to destroy very important networks. And in the world of critical infrastructure, oil, gas, water, financial services, transportation. This is a place where I think the U.S. government and private sector has to work even more closely together.
Richard Baitlick, would you agree?
Yeah, I think there is a certain amount of collaboration that will be helpful. One of the issues we've identified is that the typical models for sharing involve people sending pieces of paper to each other, or the equivalent in email. And what we've tried to promote is some type of a standard, some type of technical exchange method, so that if you have intelligence, you want to share it with someone else, you can do so. We have this thing called OpenIOC that we've shared with the community, and the idea behind that is, if you put this intelligence into a format that can be digested not just by people but by machines, you can get faster response when an attack happens, and others can learn from you and sort of take out that delay that the intruder takes advantage of.
I think that that's the question that raises to such a large extent in my own mind. That is, how long does it take to find out that an attack has occurred, Richard?
So Mandiant's own studies doing our incident response work have shown that the median time from the event first starting to the involvement of someone who can help, so you could call that the detection, or I should say the event to the detection time, was 416 days. In other words, well over a year, one of these advanced intruders has been inside a company to the point where someone decides to find it and do something about it. Now, that's a horrible number, but believe it or not, it's down from 2 to 3 years just a few years prior. So, and the other terrible stat around this is that 94% of the attacks that we worked with in the previous year were reported by a third party, such as the FBI or Air Force OSI or another intel or law enforcement organization. Only 6% were found by the victim companies themselves. So these intruders are stealthy. They find a way to accomplish their mission and then stay within the organization so they can gather more data over time.
Richard Baitlick of Mandiant. That's a cybersecurity firm. When we come back, we'll open the phones and take your calls.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
George Saunders has a new collection of short stories. How the MacArthur Genius Grant Fellow went from working in the oil fields of Asia to writing critically acclaimed fiction. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. In this hour, we're talking about cybersecurity, the kinds of threats that have already been encountered, certainly at the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, several financial institutions. Here in the studio, Michelle Kwan, president of Michelle Kwan Associates. That's a security consulting firm. Michael Leiter, senior counselor at Palantir Technologies, former director of the National Counterterrorism Center. Ellen Nakashima, national security reporter at The Washington Post, and joining us by phone from Alexandria, Virginia, Richard Baitlick, chief security officer at Mandiant, that also is a cybersecurity consulting firm. Let's open the phones now and go first to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Good morning. So listening to this discussion, there are two words, China and the Internet, which I think cause people to lose a bit of perspective in Washington. From the perspective of the technology community, which I'm part of, I just want to give a bit of a warning. So I understand that cybersecurity is an issue. It's been an issue for a long time. And there are things that government can do to help deal with this. So, for example, work with companies to help them improve their network architecture to make their network safer, and also when intrusions do occur, keep the damage to a minimum. That's great, and I hope the government will do that helpfully. On the other hand, if this is a way for the government to start monkeying with the central architecture of the Internet, the openness of the Internet, to start seizing domains or network architecture without due process, like they tried to do with the Stop Online Piracy Act, I think a big segment of the technology community is going to get very angry at that, and it'll be stopped, like the SOPA and the people were stopped a little bit over a year ago. So, you know, I understand that this is a problem, but I do tend to think that whenever the Internet and China is involved, Washington tends to overreact and to react on the side of censorship.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. That gets us, Michael Leiter, to the kind of legislation being considered on the Hill.
Yeah, Diane, I would actually agree with the caller. I consider myself as having one foot in Washington and one foot in Silicon Valley. I work for a Palo Alto-based technology company. I think the caller is right. The government has an important role here. And the legislation on the Hill that will be proposed by the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers and both Republican and Democratic co-sponsorship, provides voluntary information sharing and provides liability protection for those companies that do provide that information to the government. There are still some concerns for technology and civil libertarians, in particular how that information can be used, if it could be used for national security issues beyond cybersecurity. I think, again, government has a role here. There has to be a partnership. But government, in my view, can't get in the business of regulating very, very defined standards, because technology will move much faster than the government bureaucracy ever can.
Elton Nakashima, you've written about this, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act.
Mm-hmm. That's CISPA, the bill that Mike was referring to, that Chairman Rogers and Ranking Member Rupersberger are reintroducing again. It actually passed the full House last year, so it's, you know, very likely to pass again this year. And maybe some form of information sharing can get out of the Congress this year, because it seems that people generally, between the government and industry, agree there needs to be better information sharing. The key is, how can we do it in a way that respects privacy and civil liberties, as well as gets the right information into the right hands and is not abused. I also just wanted to point out that apart from legislation and better protection of the networks, there is also an increasing effort within the government to look at other means and levers to shape responsible behavior globally, such as using diplomacy, working on norms, getting at perhaps even sanctions or trade sanctions and with countries that may not be behaving in a way that the government thinks is appropriate.
Richard Baitlake, do you want to talk about CISPA and your view?
Certainly. I do share concerns about privacy. I think it's very important that any legislation that's proposed is specifically tailored so that people who use the Internet don't feel like it gives an ISP or a company a way or a vehicle to consider them a threat. We have to keep the focus on the real threats, the people who are stealing information. And I'd like to echo Ellen's point as well, that there are many tools that our government could bring to bear against countries that are conducting these sorts of activities. While it's difficult in the private sector to get access to information that really ties certain activities back to the countries of origin, the government knows what's happening. And using a whole-of-government approach, you could signal to countries that are conducting these activities that behavior is just not acceptable.
Michelle.
Well, I think if we're looking at solving the problem, I'm not quite sure this bill particularly does a whole lot. It spends a lot of time talking about what it won't do. There will be no tasking. There will be no authority change. The government will still have the right to classify things. It actually says very little except you all share, which, you know, I think everyone is trying to do. I think there are other ways to encourage sharing that might even step outside of the government, looking at the ITISAC, the MSISAC, the ISAC model of companies coming together and sharing with each other and the government sharing with those entities. You know, I think there are as Richard said, ways to develop more of a metadata level sharing of technical information that is then unable to be have personally identifiable information included in it. Looking at some real sound solutions that are a little bit away from legislation. I think there are a lot of things that we need legislation for in the cyber realm, especially in looking at how we prosecute cyber and in those areas. I think to actually put a bill in place to dictate sharing, I think is a little bit outside of the scope of what we really need to be doing right
now. Michael.
Diane, having spent 20 years in the U.S. government, my single biggest concern is the speed with which government can operate. And technology is going to work at the speed of technology. Silicon Valley is going to invent. Technology is going to move forward with an incredibly rapid pace. And the interagency process that is Washington is far, far slower. And we really do need a concerted effort to develop technological expertise within the U.S. government that is severely lacking. We need to increase collaboration and clarify roles and responsibilities within the U.S. government in a way that has not yet been clarified. And then we need to move this process so we have sharing, but then we are not slowing down what the private sector can do to increase defenses across the board.
All right. Let's take a caller in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, sir.
Well, you know, from an observer standpoint, I thought, from what you guys described, this problem is at least as important as the financial market problem, and we have, we have laws that govern. And since this is an international problem, we should have get together the countries and codify some laws so that everybody needs to behave and in a certain way, and that does mean that the U.S. also need to behave in a certain way, like don't throw a Stuxnet or something like that, which I've heard of, into the other side.
What about that, Richard Baitlick? It would seem that the U.S. has done its own share of cyber espionage.
That's true. I think the difference is that the U.S. and a very small number of countries, U.K., Canada, New Zealand, Australia, we confine our activities to traditional targets of espionage, military, government, law enforcement, that sort of thing, whereas many other countries take a much wider approach. I do think there should be some sort of norms developed among responsible countries. For example, you don't target another country's hospitals. You don't target their electrical grid. These sorts of things that all of us could agree should be off limits. The problem is, as we saw with WTU negotiations just a few months ago, the world seems to be divided into two definite blocks. There's sort of a Western bloc that promotes freedom and human rights, and then you've got another bloc which sees security as a method of controlling information, suppressing dissidents, and that sort of thing. So we are having trouble just sort of coming up with what does it mean to secure the Internet between these two different blocks. Taking it the next step to govern behavior, I think, will be very difficult.
All right. To Houston, Texas. Good morning, Mark.
Hi, Diana. I love your show.
Thank you.
Listen, I'm a small businessman. I'm a photographer. I also run some websites, and I have a business class firewall that I spend money and I put in. And I've noticed that there have been some login attempts, usually when my business is closed, because I have this device, I get email alerts that this is trying to happen. And I've traced the IP addresses on several occasions, and they're coming out of China. And, you know, I use a good quality device. I'm concerned that most businesses don't bother spending this kind of money to go ahead and protect themselves and rely on just the router that the phone company or whatever gives them, which I think can be easily bypassed. And I thought, when Panetta spoke about the U.S. being under cyber attack, I thought that was credible. And I thought if they're trying to get into a small businessman like me and do something with my servers. Surely what he's talking about with the, you know, the U.S. and defense, et cetera, being under attack is very credible. And I'll go offline.
The kind of cyber protection that you have, Mark, is that available to everyone?
Yeah. I have something that's called a Sonic Wall, but you have to buy it, and it's expensive. There's some subscription services on there that keep the system up to date, and, you know, as the threat monitors or the threats change, you get downloads with, you know, information on what the system is looking for. And it alerts me when something happens, and there's a log that I can go through and see what's going on. And the device cut off the attacks. So, I mean, I feel fairly secure, and the sites that I run, if I was to lose a server, I would just scratch it, reload it, and put the sites back up again. I'm not worried.
Michelle.
Well, this is a big issue, particularly with small businesses, because the cost of monitoring and securing actually only goes down as you get bigger. So it's very expensive for a small business. And relying primarily just on a firewall just really isn't going to be enough. So there may be other issues that he's dealing with that he just doesn't know about. A lot of small businesses are moving to services that provide security on top of their, you know, either a web service or a cloud service to provide a more secure environment for their IT services, and that is available today. But a small business trying to manage their own security in-house with it's a very difficult process.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Michael Leiter.
Well, if there is a silver lining here, Diane, about all these attacks, is that public awareness really has increased exponentially over the past several years. A recent poll showed that 85% of corporate executives were concerned with a cyber attack, and that actually was beyond the number that were concerned about a drop in their income for the company. So people understand this is now a threat, that a small business owner understands the threat is a good thing. We've built that awareness. Now the question is whether or not we can have the public policy response and the technical response to actually protect against these threats. And I don't think that the record over the past 5 years should give us all that much confidence yet. And I think continued focus and pressure on our elected officials on this front is really necessary.
So what about the president's expected executive order? How much good will that do here?
The president will apparently issue an executive order on Wednesday and talk about this in the State of the Union address. And that will do some things that are very good. But what it can't do is what legislation is required for, such as clarifying the legal landscape for companies to share this information on cyber threats that they experience with the government. The president can't provide liability protection, which is critical for internet service providers and the like, to provide that information to the government, and the government can then help them analyze that information and get it back out to other companies. In addition, the president, obviously, it is more difficult for him to set strict regulatory standards, which some in Congress want, and many in Congress and many in business do not want. So there's still going to be an ongoing discussion on Capitol Hill about how strict and how define these regulations on cyber standards will be.
And Richard Baitlick, I'd be interested in your response.
Well, there is a certain role for standards. However, one of the things that we found is even with the highest standards, a dedicated intruder will find a way into the company. So one of the approaches that we recommend is rather than having a vulnerability or standard-centric approach, you have a threat-centric approach. In other words, on a regular basis, minimum annually, you have someone take a look at your network and tell you, are there Russians there? Are there Chinese there? Are there hacktivists in your network? Find the intruders and then do something about it, as opposed to constantly chipping away at a standard. Because, like we said, if most of these intrusions are being found by someone else, even if you're following a standard, you're not going to know that you were hacked. So call in a professional. It's just like getting a health check once a year or being audited for your finances. You want to make sure that you're safe on an ongoing basis. And then if you have a problem, you can deal with it.
Michelle Kwan, what do you tell companies to do to protect themselves?
Well, this is going to sound odd, but we say this is a management issue. Yes, it is a technical issue to actually find the intruders and actually make the change on the system. But unless it is supported on the executive level and financially so that you can do the identification of the incident and then the understanding of the vulnerability that allowed that incident to happen, and then the remediation, and then the reporting to say how the remediation was fixed. Unless you're able to do that life cycle of security management, unless you are afforded to do that financially, it doesn't get done. And whether you're fixing the things that are you're doing just rote vulnerability, fixing every vulnerability, or whether you're actually targeting the things that are happening to you, you have to do this in some form of a risk management process. And I think that's what Rich is saying, is that you need to look at your networks and look at the risk that you're at and afford that ability to make those changes.
And monitor. Michelle Kwan, president of Michelle Kwan Associates. Michael Leiter, senior counselor at Palantir Technologies. Ellen Nakashima of The Washington Post. And Richard Baitlick, chief security officer for Mandiant, a cybersecurity consulting firm. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part.